Let's expand the conversation now with one of our favorite philosophers and ethicists, Joseph Bottom. He leads the Classics Institute at Dakota State University in Madison. Classics, by the way, stands for Collaboration for Liberty and Security Strategies for Integrity in a Cyber-Enabled Society. He is the author of An Anxious Age, The Post-Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of America. We're reaching him in Madison. Dr. Bottom, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
How old is this conversation about religious displays and government in America, really?
It has been going on so long, and we are all so tired of it. This, of course, the First Amendment originally bound only the federal government. And we had state-established religion in New England states as late as 1830. But gradually and then explicitly after the passage of the 14th Amendment, we had the First Amendment applied to the states, applied to local governments, and they were compelled not to have state religions or state sponsorships of religions. About the first part of the kind of two-prong argument that our state attorney general just put forward, about the first part, he's absolutely right. It is... our religious jurisprudence in this country has been a mess for nigh on 100 years. It was a mess with Pierce in the 1940s with that decision. The Lemon Test of the 1970s has failed. We don't have a clear sense of what is licit and what is not under the Constitution. And the Supreme Court keeps not quite giving us one. And so lawsuits get filed by absolutists like the ACLU who want to abolish all religion and all references to religion from anything that the state touches, that the government touches. And, you know, we go around and around, and our jurisprudence in religion is so confusing. The Supreme Court has consistently held, for instance, that it is perfectly all right for the national legislature for Congress to begin with a prayer. The Supreme Court itself, every session opens with a proclamation, God save this honorable court. And since that was the practice of the founders, it cannot be that the amendment the founders passed prohibited that.
Okay.
At the same time, we've just got this mess of how far that extends, what a government can do, what a government can't do. No one knows. And the Attorney General, it seems to me, our Attorney General, is absolutely right in asking for clarification. You know, can we finally have a bright line rule so that we don't have to go to court every 3 years to defend some...
I think I lost Joseph Bottom for just a moment there. Are you still there, sir?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Oh, I can hear you now. We were talking about the bright line rule. Can we finally have some clarification?
Right.
And that's where you dropped off.
So that we don't have to go to court every 3 years to find out if, you know, Lemon, South Dakota can begin their city council meeting with a prayer.
Okay. What sort of questions should the rest of us be asking as we look at these conversations? You know, what sort of conversations are really useful, and what sort of conversations are the ones where we just get stuck and we're sick of talking about it? How do we move from, you know, the basic knee-jerk reaction to a deeper thought process about this?
Well, I think understanding the history is a big help. But another way, and perhaps the best way, would be to think what the Attorney General has just asked. He's basically putting forward two propositions. One is that the state of South Dakota, like every other state, needs a bright line rule so that they can understand what they can and cannot do without endless lawsuits. The second thing that he's putting forward is a proposal that the bright line be drawn in a particular place, asking for freedom for some religious expression through the state. That second one, the Supreme Court has spoken to fairly consistently, if there's any consistency in our religious jurisprudence. The Supreme Court has said these references are allowed if they have a kind of cultural meaning. And the trouble, of course, is that we stand at a moment in which there's no clear consensus on what the culture is. There's no center left to it. The way the old Protestant mainline churches kind of gave a center to the culture for 200 years. With that gone, who's to say that the Ten Commandments are part of the mainstream of the culture? They're cultural expressions speaking to the aspirations and common good sense of the people. If they're perceived as religious, fundamentally, then they have to go. But, you know, the Supreme Court itself has Moses as a lawgiver figured on it, and along with Solon and other figures from history, so that we don't know quite how to sort all of this out. It seems to me that the common sense that the South Dakotans would demand is a sort of robust, broad-shouldered acceptance of religious difference and the fact that people are going to want to express their religious feelings in ordinary circumstances.
Is this where we come against words like sincere religious beliefs and a reasonable display? How does that kind of language or definition fit into the conversation?
It's reasonable only if you have an idea of reason at the center of culture. And of course, what we saw in Charlottesville is the complete breakdown of culture last week. And we see this this week, I guess, and we see this kind of over and over again, that the old center of culture, our kind of broad-shouldered American Protestantism, so broad, in fact, that it almost wasn't religious anymore at all, that kind of center of the culture is basically gone. And we're increasingly angry with one another. So that you can't have an old display of the Ten Commandments on a courthouse lawn anymore without it making someone angry. And, of course, our anger is fought out, hopefully, in the courts and sometimes on the streets.
Right. So what's the role of history when you talk about, depiction of Moses? Or, as we saw in Charlottesville, we were looking at a general of the Confederacy. If something has been established a long time ago, does that make a difference versus something that you're trying to, a monument you're trying to create today?
I think so. I think, time sort of adds a patina to these things. It puts moss on these old statues and allows us to see them in their context, or it ought to. If the Confederacy is a living symbol, then let's tear it down. If it's a living symbol for slavery and sedition and breaking apart the Union that Abraham Lincoln gave us this almost mystical expression of, then by God, we ought to tear down every single monument. We ought to rip Confederate battle flags off the corners of Southern states' flags. We ought to tear it down. If, on the other hand, this is an expression of our history, of where we've been, of how we've moved on, of, all the blood spilt in that war, in the Civil War, then it takes on a different valence. And we should be able to live with it. In fact, we should sort of admire this expression that calls us to contemplate our depth of being in this country, how long we've been here, how much we've been through. And I think the trouble with the people who are angry about Confederate symbols, for instance, or the Ten Commandments on a courthouse lawn, the trouble is they call into being another set of angry people who want to defend it for, perhaps for its symbolism as the Confederacy, perhaps for its symbolism as a religious imposition in the case of the Ten Commandments. Whereas if we see it instead as an expression of American history and the culture and the long tradition that we've had, there's no occasion for people to be so angry with one another.
And yet, there they are, So is it a matter of having the conversation and having the discourse, and or is it a matter of policy and clarity from the courts?
You know, I hope the court gives us clarity, and I hope that it draws the line much in the place that our attorney general wants it drawn, which is a kind of robust, commonsensical understanding that America is a nation of religious people, and you can't arbitrarily strip the public square of all religious expression. But one way or another, we need some kind of clarification, and I hope that we can accept it. I mean, one of the most interesting things about what happened in Charlottesville is you had two sides of very angry people, and the force there that represented the middle, that represented the culture in general, were the police, and they stood aside and let the two sides battle. And, of course, it's much in the news that the police did not interfere while these fights were going on. The National Guard was there and also did not interfere and let the battle kind of go on. That's a horrifying thought. If culture, the center of culture, is so gone that it's going to stand back and let the angry people fight each other, then I'm not sure even a Supreme Court decision, say, on this or anything else, is going to speak to a kind of authoritative imposition of general culture to which everyone has to subscribe, at which point we really are back in a situation of sedition and anger and riot and war.
Can you articulate why people who follow a certain faith or people who have sincerely held religious beliefs, why do they need to express their religious, preferences in the public life? When many people will say, well, that's, you know, that's your private sort of, you know, do that on Sunday. Why is it important for people of faith to be able to express that publicly?
Well, first of all, it's guaranteed under the same First Amendment. That's the second religious clause, which is the free expression clause, which is that, you know, people have the right to express their religion, not merely believe it in private, but express it. And this, you know, again, that's subject to a terribly confusing jurisprudence that, you know, we still haven't sorted out. But in answer to your question explicitly, if religion is of the deepest stuff of human existence, then to arbitrarily set aside an arena in which it may not appear, in which you've prohibited it from appearing, is to create an arena that cannot address the deep stuff of life, about how we live and how we die. And, you know, law is concerned with how we live and how we die. It passes laws about murder. It passes laws about abortion. It passes laws about euthanasia. These are all the deep, bloody stuff of human life. And if we are not allowed, if I say to every immigrant from India, you cannot bring your Hinduism and your thoughts about that into the public square, you're not allowed to vote based on that, you're not allowed to serve on a jury based on that, you're not allowed to do anything that expresses your religious convictions, I've thereby created a world in which, we have laws involving the deep stuff of life without the capacity to think, the premises by which we might think about those issues.
Is the center of the culture, as you've been referring to, been knocked away, fallen away at this point? Does it come back? Does the culture sort of morph into something new? What are your thoughts?
I don't think the center is entirely dead, but I think many of its premises, many of the props of it have been knocked away. I don't know. You know, if the center is destroyed, we end up with a situation of, you know, an unrulable culture. No one has to accept anything. And I think we do end up with riots, and we end up with a culture that looks like Charlottesville writ large. And so I hope that we can retain the culture, the center of the culture. with the idea of, you know, the family as apart from the government, as the center of a kind of culture, with the idea that rights are not granted by the government but inhere in human beings, and the amendments in the Constitution are not grants of rights, they are recognitions of pre-existing rights that all human beings have. If we can maintain that old founder's sense of what it is to be a human being and to live in a government, under a government, and to share a state with one another, then I think there is sufficient culture there to hold on to what we've had for 200 years.
You've been listening to Joseph Bottom. He's the author of An Anxious Age. He leads the Classics Department at Dakota State University, specializing in cyber ethics. Professor Bottom, thank you so much for being with us. Come back again soon.
Thanks for having me.